Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film.
conversation.
Hooray!
Hooray! Woo!
Oh, I don't like
Oh,
hooraying.
it's a rare moment when you get to hooray, Rich.
Yeah,
I'm
well,
privileged.
I did.
Privileged.
I titled the show as well. I could easily have not put in a hooray, which makes me cringe every time we do it. But it's ironic. See, the hooray is sort of why would you be hooraying another film review podcast? You know, that's the. I won't worry about it.
If they don't get that by now, they never will.
Okay, so I'm Richard Nicholas. Hello, and with me to chat about a film is Anthony Evans.
Hello.
We're two once again.
Yes, good old days again.
The good old days.
This is how it all started, folks. Just me and Rich babbling on in a small room.
Anyway, you know, that's not so bad. We'll have a nice chat anyway. So it was your pick, Anthony, and I watched it, so you know, you can at least be glad of that. But what was the pick and who done it?
Okay, well, the film this week is called The Fall, which was released in 2006. In a hospital in 1915 Los Angeles, an injured and heartbroken stuntman begins to tell a fantastic story of five heroes to a fellow patient, a little girl with a broken arm. Thanks to his fractured mind and the girl's vivid imagination, the line between fiction and reality begin to blur as his more sinister motives are slowly revealed. Well, that makes it sound a bit more like a horror film than it is, but there we go. Directed by Tarsem Singh, or just Tarsem, as he is credited here. Written by Dan Gilroy, Nico Soltanakis, and Tarsem, based on a 1981 Bulgarian film called Yo Ho Ho. The Fall stars Lee Pace, I hope I'm saying that right, Justine Waddle, Robin Smith, Leo Bill, Marcus Wesley, Jeetu Verma, and introducing Katinka Untaru as Alexandria.
Some good names.
There are.
You know, good performances generally, I'd say, from those people. But why did we end up watching this film?
Well, to be honest, this film has kind of been like in my peripheral vision for a while now, and
You just turned your neck slightly to watch it.
yeah, and it's just like, oh, look, that. So yeah, I don't know, it just come into my mind, and I thought this might be a good one to show film bin. Although it did have a lot of after watching it did have a lot of similarities to my last film, Paprika, which is also from the year 2006, which it seems is a very good year for filmmaking.
Well, for surreal dream wonderness.
Yeah, so I thought I have been I've seen some other films by Tarsem Singh, and I have to say I was never that impressed overall, but he does have a very distinct visual kind of style, which I like.
Kind of bold and epic and.
And from seeing the trailer, it looked very big and colourful and distinct, and I thought, well, give it a go.
Well, I think the thing that sold me on it was funny hats. Plenty of funny hats in it.
Oh yes, our Tarsem does have a thing for the silly hat, shall we say. I think in this film he's got just the right balance of silly hats, whereas like in other films it tips either way.
Well, there's some really avant-garde hats in The Immortals, which I think we saw in the cinema. When it came
Yes.
out, and that was the main thing I took away from it, is just how magnificent their avant-garde silly helmets and hats were.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a bit of a microcosm of how I feel about Tarsem's films, kind of in general. Like you're coming away from this epic kind of swords and sandals adventure, and all you can really think of was, oh, weren't the hats a bit ridiculous and silly? It's all about kind of the aesthetic.
Yeah, I think that might be key to this one because when I saw the trailer, because we both didn't watch it before it was suggested, right? We both came to this fresh.
Yes, pretty much.
And I was expecting it to be potentially a little bit style over substance because if it had had the key bit of substance, it might have become a very famous and successful film because it certainly has a strong visual look. And then, you know, if the substance had been there, surely people would have heard of it more than. I mean, I hadn't heard of it, so.
Yes, I have to admit that's kind of how I was feeling coming into it as well, because he is like Tarsem's been called pretentious on more than one occasion, shall we say? And I tend to agree.
Just in the streets, people heckling.
He does have a tendency of kind of style over substance. So I was hoping there would be more coming in. But honestly, I didn't have my hopes up that much.
Sure. I mean, you know, you are one for dreamy fantasy movies, like kind of stuff that's sort of a bit weirder and a bit more, perhaps the meaning of a film is more obtuse or something.
So, more cerebral.
Yeah. So I knew it was the sort of thing that you would perhaps enjoy more than me, just because that's more your bag. But I didn't worry too much about what I expected. But I did have an inkling that it would maybe lack a bit of substance. There's two stories being told, really. I mean, there's literally two stories being told by the characters in the film. But, I mean, there's the story set in a hospital, and there's the children's story, is it? It's just a...
It's just another story within the story being told, which kind of reflects on the story being told.
Well, that made no sense. That does make sense, but the simple thing is, there's a man in a hospital telling a little girl a story, and that story is played out on a very bold and imaginative scale, and then that's intercut with the story of the little girl and the man in the hospital, who, as you said, is a injured stuntman. And the little girl is an injured little girl who usually, I think, would pick oranges. That seemed to be the reason she was injured, is being incompetent at picking things from high up. And it happens twice. So she's failed twice in her life at that such a young age to grasp something high.
That's a good point. This film is called The Fall, but really it should be called Lots of Falls.
Yeah,
I suppose.
Because I said, initially when the title came up, I was like, "Oh, The Fall, is that a documentary about the post-punk band The Fall?" I guess it wasn't, because I didn't see Mark E. Smith once, and I mean, it had nothing to do with contemporary music. So I was a bit disappointed, to be honest. I could have watched a documentary about The Fall. They're quite an interesting band.
Well, maybe that'll be a future episode of Film Bin, because that actually seems like it would fit in.
The alternate thing I thought was it might be about autumn. It wasn't really about autumn either.
No.
But it is about many, many falls, because the stuntman has to do a fall. We get kind of a beautiful black and white bridge scene that's going on.
The opening credits. It's like, I thought they were... That's the best black and white cinematography I have seen ever in film, to be perfectly honest. And it's just... It's a weird way to open, because you're not immediately aware of its relevance, I suppose, to the rest of the film. But it's just kind of very just beautiful.
It's and slow the motion and the music and everything.
Yeah. And it just kind of captures you in, even though you're not quite aware yet of what's going on.
Yeah.
I think, at this point, we should state whether we like the film or not, because I think it's going to be quite... a divisive point. Because personally, I think this is probably the best film I've seen in many years.
Wow, that's high praise. I did not get on with it very much. And I think it's because... But from the get-go, it's quite an interesting look to the film. We've got a train on a bridge, some men possibly jumping off the high bridge, which got so there's a steam train, there's a horse suspended in midair, there's various people working on something or other. It's interesting. And then we don't get to know about what it was initially until we get spoon-fed it, and it's kind of a film that banks on you being like, oh yeah, what's all this about? And then being willing to sit through it all to get to the conclusion of, oh...
But that's the thing I like about the film. It kind of... The whole thing is so layered, and there's so many kind of nuances to it that it kind of demands your attention, not just in how, visually stunning it is, but just how cerebral it is. The only kind of comparison I can think of is... sometimes you sit down to watch a film, and you start watching it, and, after a while, maybe you'll get your phone out and put that away, and you'll just get distracted because the film at points doesn't really demand your attention that much.
Right.
But with this one, I found it just caught my attention, and the whole film just flew by.
Oh, well, I did not get any of that. I don't know. I felt like if I had a phone that needed checking, I might have checked it a few times. Because after the scene of like, ooh, what's all this about? It's, oh, hospital. Great. People who are ill and are going to have tragic stories, no doubt. And we'll slowly learn why they're, you know, the little girl is in like a cast that holds her arm up. But she annoyingly holds a box in it all the time. Like a box with little bits and bobs that are sort of about her life and her and things. But the way she just, it looks A, painful, and B, awkward when she wanders around with it. And of course, you know, people who are paralysed at the legs are always going to have cheery stories. So I was ready for bleakness. Admittedly, there is bleakness, but there's a lot there's a lot more about, I guess, storytelling and the imagination and things, isn't it?
Yeah. I suppose a good comparison with this movie would be the film Pan's Labyrinth.
I was going to say, actually, it reminded me in parts like The Devil's Backbone, which I think is made by the same dude, isn't it?
It is, yeah, by Guillermo del Toro. But it just seems like an obvious comparison, kind of a story told from kind of a child's perspective and like set in like a really harsh reality, and then who retreats into a kind of more epically fantasy based world because of like all the tragedy going on around her.
Yeah, I agree, it is like that, and that's probably why I didn't get on, because I'm not a fan of Pan's Labyrinth. I don't know. I thought some of the horror elements in Pan's Labyrinth kind of didn't appeal to me. But like that's a very treasured film by the people who know and like it, and I didn't fall into that category. So maybe that's why, because it's in that wheelhouse. I'm just like, no, thanks.
No, fair enough. And I mean, I don't really know why this film hasn't kind of garnered the same kind of attention as Pan's Labyrinth has. I personally think this is a stronger film.
I think I could shed some light on it, but I don't want to be too mean, because it is engaging in that you sort of get these two characters who play off each other. They're kind of nice, actually. The stuntman, there's obviously ulterior motives going on, but he's being pleasant to this little girl, and she's interesting.
Yeah, like the whole film is. It's just the relationship between these two characters. I mean, there are a lot of other characters in here, like especially in the kind of fantasy story.
Yeah.
But they're kind of peripherals. It's kind of it's all. If you think about it, it's all from the perspective of the little girl. So it's how she is interpreting everything that she or we are seeing.
And to capture her imagination, presumably, there's quite the budget to get all of the locations that she imagines. Because she's like, they're filmed at some really like high-end architecture, like from around the world, and some of the grandest pieces of landscape and famous places in Europe, in India and Asia. Like, they're pretty much everywhere. They kind of globetrot just for what is essentially like little moments throughout the story. And I would suggest that rather than it being about two characters that are very interesting, it's actually about two characters telling the story of really bland and two-dimensional characters.
But the thing I like is how the story, like all the elements of the story, can be linked back to the story that's going on between the two characters in real life.
It's that kind of I guess the most famous example is probably The Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy dreamt about all the people she lived with being in her fantasy world representing
her. Yeah, and the similar things going on here. Like, the child is obviously using, like, the people and the things that she knows, and she's implanting them into the story. For example, I think, like, her box that you mentioned ends up in the story, being carried around by one of the characters. Like a letter she writes at the beginning ends up in there. And it's just how, like, kind of this kind of child's innocent perspective is kind of peppering the whole thing.
I guess essentially, because it's told by a man who's manipulating a little girl. Basically, their story is he is probably dealing with depression, what with having his legs
yes.
be.
So yeah, so he's a possibly paraplegic now, stuntman, who well that's quite bleak because that kind of means like well he's out of a job now and he can't walk and that in itself is depressing, but not only that like. The subtext that comes out slowly through the girl's kind of like own perspective. And I like that. It kind of gives you a little bit at a time and it doesn't kind of force it down you, but then it isn't so subtle that you don't know what's going on.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, essentially he wants to overdose on morphine and he is going to get the little girl who can, you know, get up and about because it's her, only her arm that's injured. And he can manipulate her to get the morphine so he can overdose and be gone from this world or whatever. And the little girl, I guess, is looking for, you know, is bored. It's a hospital and she's just slowly healing. And, you know, she has a sort of storytelling father figure in him. And, you know, wants the company and is enjoying this story that he's telling, I guess. And that's the key, really, is there's a man trying to manipulate a little girl and there's a little girl who's bonding with him. And he's sort of telling the story, and then as it goes on, she tries to manipulate the story like she's being manipulated in a way, and make it go in a way she would like, you know, people not dying, and the heroes living and succeeding, and, you know, things like that. So that's kind of, you know, the way their story goes. But I think, okay, so the story they tell then, we should probably focus on, although they do start with the story, an anecdote about Alexander the Great, is it?
Yes, that's the kind of like the in to the dream, isn't it? And it's kind of it doesn't really go anywhere. And I think it's more of a setup of like, ooh, this is what we're going to be doing, so expect this. But it is visually just wonderful. And apparently, there are no CGI effects at all in this film.
They haven't even like upped the color gradient a little bit. They must have, surely.
Oh well, maybe that. But like everything. You know, it's shot it's on location, all the stunts.
Costume stunts and location. I mean, locations, every bit. It's kind of, it probably should have spent less money going to these locations because, you know, there's such a short bit. You'd think, I know that you filmed that bit in the desert where the peak is just right and the sand is so beautiful and everyone looks spectacular from distance and close up. But you feel like, I don't know if you should have. I feel if I was the producer of this, I'd be very, like, I would be sweating. In fact, didn't the guy produce this with a lot of his own money? I think that's one of the bits I heard.
Yes, it is a bit of a passion project, as a lot of people like to call these things. But, you know, he, like, Tarsem apparently spent 4 years going around the world with his own money filming all of these shots.
I bet he wishes this had done better as well.
And I think it's an incredible undertaking.
It's so rare.
It's so rare when a kind of passion project like this comes off so well. Because usually they are disasters. And I don't think this is at all.
I think he might have overindulged a little bit. But then it was his money.
Oh, I don't know. Because I guess a lot of people would come into this. And by the end, they're like, well, that was quite like style over substance. Rather pretentious. But I don't think it's pretentious at all, because essentially pretentious means like you're saying there's more meaning than there is. But I don't think so. I think this is there's so many layers and so many ways to look at this film.
I don't know. I think with a pretentious lens on might be the right way, because I don't know. I don't want to debate how many layers there are, but I do want to look more at the story they tell, because I think it's key to my disengagement with it, because it's about, was it four, didn't it, four, five? No, it's kind of six characters the story's about, initially. There's four, five heroes and then an extra hero. Is that right? Like, should we go through them?
Yeah, there's like the five, like, main ones. That kind of like the, I think of it as kind of like the, kind of like action movie lineup.
Yeah.
Because that's the good way that they're introduced. Like, I thought this was like one of the most engaging parts of the film was when they were being introduced. And it really felt like an old movie or like an old cartoon kind of thing where you're being introduced to the heroes one by one and given their backstory.
Yeah, okay. So we've got, let's say, the main, the kind of our hero who's eventually represented by the guys telling the story, he is a Spanish masked man. What's his name? Like, is he just called Masked Man?
He's just the Masked Bandit, I believe.
And he's sort of got kind of traditional Spanish-looking clothes and a red mask and a you know, interesting hat. And he is your kind of... I don't know, he doesn't really have a thing, does he? He, like, you know, is a bandit, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose he's got the least development because, as it turns out, he is the most avatar-like of Roy, who is the stuntman.
Yeah. And so there is the Indian. Well, they do a kind of interesting thing with the Indian, because in her imagination, the Indian is an Indian man from India, and he's sort of in green cloak and a kind of interesting sort of hat turban thing, and he's bearded and, you know, what's his thing of choice?
His oh, wow, that was a weird start to a sentence. His main kind of plot thing is that his wife was kidnapped and ultimately killed by the Governor Odious, this kind of big malevolent villain that we don't really get to see until the end, who has affected all our heroes in some way.
Yeah, and it's talked about as if he's a Native American, because it mentions, like, is it a...
A wigwam, and, yeah, just, like Native American kind of...
terminology.
Words. Yeah, but the little girl, obviously, has no reference to that, so she interprets it as an Indian from India.
Yeah.
And because that's what she understands the word Indian to mean.
And that's sort of, you know, creative. And I think that's what clued me in mainly to the idea that, oh, this is what we're seeing is the child's imagination of the story, whereas his perspective presumably is a little different. And that's interesting enough. So we've got Indian guy, and his gimmick is when he's anxious, he touches his eyebrows. That doesn't seem to come up very much. He gets in a situation where he might be killed, touches his eyebrow. I don't know what that was about, but hey, he's there. And we've got our explosive expert, Luigi, who kind of wears a weird red, not a teacher's.
Yellow, it's kind of like a yellow coat.
With flames on the back, like orange flames, and like a red like hat thing that's sort of just a bit odd. And he likes smoking a cigar and has a blunderbuss or something, and bombs, yeah. And so, you know, that. And his thing is, everyone's not allowed to hang out with him, and he's not allowed to go to church, so he's annoyed that he can't go to church, so he's got a vendetta against this governor villain man. Is that right? I mean, no one really gets much of they get, you know, an explanation, but I don't know if they have that much going on otherwise. But, we also have an ex-slave who decides to wear horns as his uniform when he's not a slave, but fundamentally just looks like a slave. And he's upset because when he's slaving away, and it is, you know, a big horrible toil, his brother, who's chained next to him, dies, just sort of passes out and dies. And then he decides to cut himself free with his machete and free everyone and become a hero for the slaves. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And
so yes, so like these characters are kind of...
Oh, there's one more.
Oh, I suppose.
And I can't let it slide because it is probably the one that offends me the most. And the other character is Darwin, a young Darwin.
Yes, okay.
Who not only is not the, you know, he's sort of interested in nature, that's his story, and Darwin was, as we know, and discovery, and...
And was an explorer.
Yes.
Yes.
But he is...
So as a character, he kind of fits in.
I just...
kind of story. But then, yes, he's not the obvious representation of Charles Darwin. But then, on the other hand, this is in the fantasy of a little girl.
Yes.
So he can look like whatever he wants to.
Of course, yes. And this little girl chooses to imagine Darwin, a bearded man who would probably wear tweed. He might not have been bearded when he was, you know, early on, but that's how we know him.
No.
But he's a young, normal-looking, thin man who wears a ridiculous, colourful coat, like big red and like white furry coat, and a bowler hat. And he has, and I don't know why this myth presents, I don't know why this happens in stories sometimes, but he has the companion of a monkey. I think in like the Aardman pirate film, Darwin is with a monkey as well. And I don't know why this is. Why chimps? I know why chimps are, you know, relevant to Darwin, but he didn't have a sidekick. But in this he does. And so there's this young, ridiculous-looking hipster, emo, I don't even know, he's just a weirdo that represents Darwin, who has no place in this story at all, but is in it anyway. So in a way, it kind of annoys me because it betrays the actual interesting figure. Darwin, tremendously interesting man, so important to science, and yet he's just a weirdo in a coat who is obsessed with one butterfly. And that's why he hates the governor, because the governor sent him a dead butterfly.
Okay, I have done some reading on this, and it does kind of make sense when you realize the kind of reference, because the monkey is a reference to one of Charles Darwin's colleagues who essentially...
Was a monkey?
No, who essentially wrote The Origin of Species with Charles Darwin, but has essentially, over the years, just had no recognition for it.
Yeah, that's true. I guess there is a subtext that the monkey tells him everything.
Yeah, so, yeah, and that's the kind of subtext going along, which I suppose is kind of symbolic of the whole kind of film stuntman nature of Roy, too. It's a very kind of similar thing where someone is getting all the credit for something that someone else is doing.
Oh, okay, right. So we're peeling back a few of these layers that I couldn't see initially.
And I think each of, like, the main five heroes are... like, a part of, like, Roy's psyche, in a way.
All right. Okay.
You see, so they each, in their own way, represent him or a way that he is thinking at the time that he's telling the story.
Right. Okay.
It's lots of layers.
Didn't pick up on those layers, though. I don't know. There's also a weird introduction, slightly after the heroes are told about, of... weird native-looking tree man who emerges from a burning tree and then is sort of dirty and covered in mud and has weird dreads and sort of talks weirdly. And apparently Darwin can understand him and translate with what seems to be sign language for some reason, what the weird tree man says. I don't know if I understood that character. Later on, he gets bitten or something. He poisons himself and then gets saved by a bunch of other tree men who chant stuff, and Darwin can interpret the map that's appearing on him.
Okay, I think the problem here is you're trying to put too much logic onto what is essentially a dream.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I was trying to follow a narrative, that's all.
I mean, the film is quite clear that it is a story, and that... it is likely to change, like, you know, they change the look of the main character just at a whim. They change how the story's going.
Yeah.
Just at the whim of Roy, who at some point kind of clicks on that he can use this story to manipulate the girl into getting him morphing.
Yes, but like all good stories that are passed down and told, and there's something nice about listening to someone tell a story, and occasionally when you make them up, they are quite fantasyful and weird, and almost, if you've just made it up, it maybe doesn't have a point in mind to get to. But you should probably have a good narrative arc or strong motivation, rather than just, reasons. We got reasons, and we're going to kill a man. And then we're just all over the place, and it's very hard to follow, and no one does anything kind of coherent towards developing themselves, apart from going to the next bit of place.
But again, like, the lack... like, the characters don't get development because they're all Roy, essentially.
Well, Roy is a terrible storyteller, and I can't help but feel...
Well, yes, but that's kind of the point. It's meant to be loose and kind of, like, dreamlike, because he's just telling the story on the fly. Not only that, But there's, like, the girl is, you know, injecting herself, literally at one point injects herself into the story to change it.
Yes.
So I don't mind it being so incoherent in that kind of way, because it works like that, I find.
I get that justifies the story, but there is still a man who made a film and has a message to send, and I just didn't enjoy being told a really meandering and confusing story about people who have sort of vague outlines, and then they just sort of accompany one man who loves someone, but then he doesn't because she's affiliated with a bad guy and I have to kill him, but I can't because Roy in real life is upset now, so the story's going badly. Like, I couldn't really get into it because there wasn't Roy told a rubbish story. I don't know, the girl liked it, but that did not mean that I did.
No, well, fair enough. I guess, you know, it's not everyone's going to like this. It isn't your standard narrative film, I suppose. Because if you break it down, like, the plot I give at the beginning really does not do the film justice as to what it is. And yet that is, like, really the only story of the film.
I think with rewatching, it would improve upon viewing, but I still think it is a little bit like, you know, it's clearly a passion project for the creator, and it is beautifully filmed, and it has seemingly some symbolism and metaphor, it's a piece about dreams, which is always an awkward area, but I feel like it is too boring a story to tell to have made all the effort for. Like, I kind of found it dull. The hospital story goes very slowly, and the stories they tell, because I couldn't follow them, because they sort of are a dreamlike ad-libbed story, seemingly, I just didn't enjoy the characters in them. They just sort of were there doing just a bit of getting shot at and running away. I don't know.
No, I understand that. I understand that. Like, other than Roy and Alexandria, there pretty much might as well not be any other characters in the film.
Some of the elements I did like in the hospital scenes were, you got weird little moments between the other patients. Like, there was an old man who's represented in the story they're telling, but there's an old man who just tries to cheer her up, and he's quite nice. He sort of has false teeth he takes out and weirdly plays with them and tries to eat an orange and things. I think there's a kindly priest that is quite nice to the girl. So there's a few nice characters in the hospital, and there's a nurse as well who's very nice to her and cuddles her when she can't sleep. I can't help but feel any of these other characters would have been better her befriending them and maybe them telling her story and not being manipulated by the slightly selfish Roy who's feeling bad for himself. Because he really does, he's not even nice to her when he, you know, essentially, right, he tells this story and he gets her to get the morphine, and, you know, that's an interesting part of the story. But when she has a fall getting him more, he still decides to kill all the characters that she likes in the story one by one, and almost tells the story where he dies, his character dies, and just in a really pathetic way, and then he's still begrudging her.
But that makes sense, because that would be his true low point, is not only has he, like, manipulated this girl into making him, like, allowing him to commit suicide, but he's also made her come to harm. So when his like, kind of realization of that is at his lowest point, and that's when, like, the story is, like, really trying to get dark, when everyone is dying. And not only that, all the people who die in the end are, they give their own lives. Like
save Roy's character, essentially. And
yeah.
Her.
So he's kind of, like, trying to justify to her that, you know, killing yourself is not always the, you know, a bad thing.
I don't know, though, because it's at that point where he's caused her harm through his own selfishness and manipulation, they still has no remorse, and he just does.
No,
he does turn it around in the end, I suppose.
I think that's harsh. I wouldn't say he has no remorse. If he had no remorse, he wouldn't be there, like, crying over her body, essentially. And, you know, that is his lowest point, like, and ultimately it is the girl who kind of snaps him out of it.
I think,
kind of like right at the end, when everyone's dead and it's just him and he's drowning at the bottom of a pool, and the obvious, and like the subtext has become a lot more obvious now that they're talking about themselves.
Yeah.
And I thought that end bit where she is begging him
not to murder die his character
was seriously the most heart-wrenching bit of film I have seen in a long time.
You want to check out Schindler's List? That stuff's real. It's real emotion. I don't know. I found it. I think it's because Roy is such. He appears to be a nice guy. He's not a proper villain. He's just so caught up in his own depression, which is kind of there rightly, and his own selfishness to kind of end his own life. And even though he's seemingly making genuine friends with this little girl, he's still so mean about it. I think I'm annoyed that he can't tell a more compelling and sensible story. It's kind of so obvious he's just making it up as he goes along. It's almost like, well, why does the little girl care? She's invested in characters that I'm not invested in, so I kind of feel a bit annoyed that they're so upset about it when, I guess, you know, there's a personal bond between the two, but he's still mean, and I don't know if it was all that brilliant a conclusion just to have him essentially go, I guess, and then he stands up and punches the guy, and then goes to deal with the femme fatale or whatever the woman is, and is sort of like, I mean, we didn't really talk much about the woman that the team of, you know, weirdos all rescue from slaves. It's a princess who wears a weird hat again, keeping the theme, and a veiled hat, and she's rescued from slaves. They ditch her nephew or something, and the story moves on, and then instantly our Spaniard masked character falls in love with her and is annoyed. Like, it kind of, there's elements of the story that don't even go with anything that sort of get ditched because it's sort of an ad lib story, I thought.
True, but I think there is, from the start of when he's telling the story, that there is like subtext to it, but you're not quite sure of what it is yet, and then it is slowly revealed, like, over time, and everything is just made really clear.
Well, I don't know. Like, because what? He is a bit annoyed because Roy's real-life girlfriend has left him and started a relationship with the actor who he works with. Is that right?
Yes.
And so
that's what's implied, anyway.
And the female character in it is meant to represent that, and obviously Roy has conflicting emotions about this woman, and therefore he has a sort of on-and-off kind of like and hatred of this woman he's trying to save. And the conclusion is essentially he gets up from the pool where he's giving up and drowning, punches the bad guy, goes to be with this woman, then goes, I'm just going to be with my sort of weird tiny Spanish daughter who represents the girl who's having the story told to her. And, I mean, how does it, like, what's the end of their big epic story that they don't get together? Or, like, I don't know if it left that much of a impact on me.
Well, like I said, the story, how do I put this? The whole kind of fantasy, like I said before, it's kind of like the superhero lineup of a Saturday morning cartoon. And I suppose, like, if you think about it, the fantasy world is, you know, bright, colourful, everyone speaks in a kind of overdramatic way. It is essentially kind of like an old film or a Saturday morning cartoon.
Well, yeah, they try and draw parallels to the sort of films that he's a stuntman in, you know, the broad strokes, heroes and villains thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So the way, like, the end wraps up, it kind of makes sense, like, because, okay, the villain will overcome, like, the bad guy, and
the villain overcomes the bad guy?
He overcomes the villain, reclaims the girl, even though the real meaning of it is that he's over her now, or at least over his kind of... She's not giving him suicidal thoughts anymore, I suppose.
But essentially, in story, she just goes, it was all a test, and he's like, whatever, it wasn't a test, I don't like you.
I think that's kind of like the little girl's insertion at the end, because, like,
she wants to make sense of this nonsense.
When she says that, she kind of folds her arm in a kind of grumpy kind of look, And she's like, well, I don't like how that's ending. Because she now realizes when they were having like the discussion when she was in bed after the fall, she herself realizes that the person in the story is the woman in real life. So I think that's her influence on the ending of the story there, that they don't get back together.
Yeah, I guess it's because she knows that, you know, for Roy, he just needs to realize that his life isn't worth ending and that she likes him, and therefore there's hope for Roy, and therefore he's the character he, you know, is represented by. Yeah, I guess. And, you know, I've seen worse stories, and there's definitely a lot of work done to sort of intertwine their, you know, the real life story, if you will, of the people in hospital and their, you know, history, and the fictional characters. But I feel like because Roy tells a kind of stupid story that I don't get into, I begrudge any connection and the clever intertwining, because it's like, well, it really wasn't that intriguing. I don't know.
No, fair enough. I think we can agree that the story of the film is not the strong point, but then it's not really the focus, I suppose, because this is a film about spectacle.
It's kind of...
And just taking film to its kind of maximum kind of spectacle through just filming locations and costumes.
And vacuous, just nothingness being filmed in a grand way. Just absolutely decorative, visually amazing, but no substance. Style. Just style. Like, I don't know. Okay, I will agree that it is, you know, an interesting piece about storytelling. And it's kind of a battle between a little girl who's nice and trying to be a friend and a depressed man. And it is kind of a struggle to tell one narrative and trying to, you know, essentially get the victory over whether it's a harrowing tale or a tragedy. And that's interesting.
Okay. But,
You don't think it's just style over substance? You think...
Oh, not at all. I think there's... Like, I can see why some people would think it's pretentious, but I think there's a lot of humour in there.
There is a lot of humour in it, I would say.
Kind of undercuts that, which makes it more fun and interesting. Like, if the story was being told absolutely, like, kind of straight, then I think it really wouldn't have worked.
I think the charm...
But, like, the insertions all the time to the story of stuff that's happening, like, in real life, it's really interesting. What can I say? I think this is a really good film.
I would say I find the little girl a likeable actress. I thought they put in a lot of stuff, because there's a sort of potentially foreign, like, is she's Romanian or something? Or like, there's definitely a foreign thing going on.
Yeah, I think she's either Romanian or Bulgarian or from that kind of region. And I think she is the core that holds all of this film together. She is just amazing.
Like, I like the expressions on her face, and I like the not quite understanding sometimes, because sometimes she doesn't understand what Roy is saying to her in a sort of language barrier, and other times in a sort of child naive way. And the fact that there is this idea that I think she has some idea that Roy is lying to her occasionally, because he's not the best at lying and making up reasons why you can't just ask the nurse. She's quite reasonable, the little girl. She's like, I'll ask the nurse for you. And it's like, no, you have to get them yourself. I need it because I'm tired and things.
Yeah, and she is like just an intelligent, kind of insightful, kind of free-spirited girl character. Yeah. And it's nice to see there. And I think the way that a lot of her scenes were filmed are kind of very improvised. And that really works.
And she's very cute. Like, cute as a button.
Oh, yeah.
Or whatever.
So endearing and cute.
And I like the way she kind of just sort of makes little noises or does little things when she's bored. Or, like, the way she sort of half sometimes looks like she's paying attention. And there's a lot of little nuances that are in the film that make it feel like a very real person, you know? So I think there's a lot of work done on the little kid's behalf. And being so young, that's such a good job. So that's one of the better things. Her character is very good and portrayed in a lovely way. And I do like a little weird accent foibles and things. And
yeah,
interesting.
It really works because, like, one of the problems with, like, child actors is that they're going to come off sounding insincere.
Mm.
And that really doesn't happen here. And I think the fact that she doesn't speak English really helps there.
Well, I mean, she does. I mean, weirdly, one of the things is that Roy can't read English and she can or something. That's one of the problems. And she kind of, I don't know, there's some misreading of things. But essentially, she speaks or reads English when others don't or something. I'm kind of not quite sure what.
I don't think that was like a big point. I think there's just she's learning to write, and that's why her kind of first messages seem gibberish.
Yeah. And also, like, she is. It would be so easy for this to be a thick idiot kid who doesn't get that she's being manipulated, but because she uses lies herself occasionally for her own child purposes, and is a bit mischievous, that kind of plays to Roy's favour to some extent. And I think it makes a more interesting three-dimensional character of the little girl because she's intelligent. There's an implication she understands that she's being lied to, but also a kind of childlike friendliness that stops her, you know, saying, oh, you're horrible, Roy, or whatever. And she keeps bonding with him despite, you know, him basically going, I'm going to sleep now, or I don't want to tell any more story, or basically just lying flat out to her.
Yeah.
But that's that, because where you've seen layers and interesting symbolism and dream intertwining with reality, I have seen a bland, epic story, beautifully told, but kind of not engaging me enough. Like, this, just all the characters in the story they tell don't have that much to them. Like, oh, the Indian guy doesn't look at other women because of his beautiful wife that died, and there's something going on about beauty and women and, I don't know. Like, it all didn't interest me, and I just, because it was like an ad-libbed story that, you know, wouldn't have, it kept my interest if I was a broken-armed little kid and Roy was trying to entertain me. But then, saying that, right, my grandfather, who was blind when I knew him, he used to read a children's book to me, and I didn't know he was blind, so how he wrote a page read it to me, I don't know. He obviously ad-libbed a story, so maybe my childhood innocence was lost, but I have had a blind man tell a story to me assuming perfectly well that it's the book. So, what do I know?
See, didn't you just have a profound moment there where the film now makes so much sense? No. Okay. I suppose we should also talk about Roy, played by Lee Pace.
Right, yeah, go on.
Who, he's not had that many roles in films. I remember him on a TV series called Pushing Daisies, which no one saw. And recently he's been playing lots of villains in fantasy films, like The Hobbit and Guardians of the Galaxy.
Who is he in that?
Oh, he's the villain. What's his name? Ronan? Is that his name?
Oh, right. It's because he's caked in so much, you know, stuff.
I think he's a really good actor, and his portrayal of Roy here is really heartbreaking at points.
Yeah, you feel sorry for Roy rather than an adjective. It would be quite easy to be like, oh, this guy's lying to a child. And because you see a sort of patheticness in him, you don't end up hating him. I don't like his story, but I did like him. I felt sorry for him. And I thought the touching thing came to fruition at the end for him, where I guess the conclusion that was that, you know, after the hospital thing, the little girl healed and she never saw Roy again. But he was said to have been a stuntman in something else, even though he probably wasn't. And she saw him, every stuntman that did a fall in like a early turn of the century movie, she saw that as being Roy.
Yeah, which I thought was quite poetic. Because, like, at the end it kind of says, like, well, my mum says Roy made a full recovery and now he's working in films and everything's happy. And then she says, like, but I didn't believe her until I saw him.
But then he's...
And then I just thought it was like a nice poetic moment then at the end where she kind of imagines Roy as like every stuntman who ever lived, like in every film.
Yeah, because there's one
even though us as an audience are still unsure and skeptical as to whether he made a full recovery or not. Like,
well, I think at first it's like, well, he could have been in one. But I took it to mean she saw him in it because she wanted to see him in it. And then we see loads of like really famous black and white like stunt movies of the past, and it's like, well, he's not all of these guys.
Yeah.
Like, so I took it to like her childhood innocence remained intact, whereas Roy perhaps just probably did top himself like in real life, but she doesn't know that.
Yeah, which is kind of like, I suppose, the big tragedy of the film, which is averted, because I suppose any film which centres around a child has to be about the loss of innocence.
Okay, I guess I'm almost coming to something that I like, and that's, I like that in their narrative they told together, she won and got a kind of happier ending, and then as soon as they're separated from hospital and don't see each other, Roy kind of got his tragedy and stayed crippled, presumably, and she got her happy ending how she wanted it, in a way.
Yeah, because like the most heart-wrenching part of the story is when you think like Roy is going to kill everyone and he's going to commit suicide, and she will like lose her like all of her childhood innocence, essentially. So it's nice like at the end that she doesn't.
Yeah, and they've been on kind of, in real life, they've been on a bit of a roller coaster, what with her thinking that she may have helped Roy kill himself. Then, oh no, someone's being carted out of the hospital. Ah, oh, but it's obviously not going to be Roy. And then it isn't Roy, but it's the lovely old man with the false teeth. Oh, and let's all have a big hissy fit and, like, have a cry and stuff. And what was kind of weird, actually, is Roy's reaction to being... I think didn't Roy was more cross that he had eaten some placebos instead of morphine or something?
Yeah. Like, yeah, because when he woke up from his... suspected would be his like final kind of sleep. When he woke up from that, that's when he like truly kind of lashes out.
Yeah, there's a bit of a temper on him, but then, you know, paralyzed from the waist down. I thought he was kind of coming back to the actor. I thought he was good. I did like him in the character, but the character was. He would lose his temper occasionally, and you'd think, well, maybe this kid shouldn't keep coming back. Like, I perhaps would have been put off by a man who, you know, is a terrible storyteller and a liar and a manipulator and has a weird short fuse occasionally. So, you know, I might have gone to someone else for a story. Maybe the nice nurse.
I get that, but like, after kind of a while, they do kind of have a kind of secret kind of rapport together. Like, he is telling, like, her the story, like, in the sheets where no one else can, like, see them or anything. And, like, he is scheming, but she does kind of know that he's scheming. So I kind of see why she is, attracted by that relationship.
Yeah.
Probably not the best word to use with children, but there you go.
As actors, they do create a real bond and a genuine rapport, like you say. I wouldn't say any of this is down to bad acting. I just think I would have preferred all of this effort and passion and quality costumes and locations had been used on a cleverer, it was clever because it was trying to interweave real life and a story and talking about narrative and dream. But I think the story they should have told should have been better. I just think it should have been a more enjoyable few characters.
I see what you're getting, because it is such a spectacle, and like it, those bits demand your attention so much. I suppose you're expecting it to be the best part of the film, like.
So, having said that, stuff that does similar things, like The Wizard of Oz, if you think about the characters and stories in that, it's all pretty stupid. How there's an idiot man conning people and telling them to go and kill a witch, and then she dies because water gets splashed on her. There's lots of things in The Wizard of Oz that are perfectly stupid and kind of almost feel ad-libbed at times. But I think I feel like the characters in Wizard of Oz, I like them more and find them more interesting. Whereas the five or six characters in this, the Indian, the slave, the Spaniard, the explosive guy, they all kind of, they just look funny. And that's kind of it.
Yeah, fair enough. I see that point of view.
So, you know, what can we say in conclusion, really? Have we missed anything else off that we kind of should have maybe mentioned a bit more?
The score is very good.
Sure, tick. It was effective.
Oh, there's so many things. There's so many layers I could talk about. Like, you know, it is a film about filmmaking. It's a film about storytelling, and these are like really kind of high concept things to be talking about in a film. But I see where you're coming from, that some of the locations and costumes are somewhat arbitrary.
And just the locations are so bold and so grand. Yes, it's nice to have them in a film, but they just feel like postcard backgrounds to, you know, just scenes where people run up a bit of a hill or go into a place. There's no reason why they're at the Taj Mahal. They're in some grand, like, Muslim mosque or, you know, like, there's so many cool places. They just have no reason to be there.
But, like, what I do like is the kind of irony that he captures, like, this perfect kind of fantasy land, but with actual places that actually exist on Earth, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so a child's imagination is quite grand, and he matches that with grand locations in reality.
Yeah, so it's just that kind of irony where the most fantasy part of it is actually the most real part of it.
It's almost like a good, if you've ever got enough money to travel the world, you should go to all these places and maybe actually learn about them rather than just, you know, put on a costume and film something.
There definitely was a kind of sense of kind of history during those fantasy parts, because you knew all these places exist around the world, and you're like just fascinated by how beautiful they are and how they still exist
and how,
after clearly being there for like hundreds of years.
And how they've paid for the day so there's no tourists about to clog up all the picturesque scenes. I think part of my disappointment comes from having watched the odd art documentary and architecture thing. If you learn about the places they filmed at, there's some really compelling stories, like groundbreaking discoveries that have influenced the architecture and design, and stuff to do with religion that has informed the design of locations, historical places where things have happened, and it's almost, you know, just used for its visual beauty rather than its historical importance.
Yes, I kind of agree with you there, but it does bring it to your attention.
It does. It's meshing many, many cultures together in, I guess, essentially the mind of a child through the terrible storyteller of a stuntman who's a bit depressed. And I guess that's, you know, what it's about, really, is this, how the imagination works in relation, like how people interpret a narrative, I guess, as well. Like it's the imagination, which is, you know, even though it's a storyteller who's got motives and is a bit depressed, it doesn't mean that something visually interesting isn't happening in the mind of the person hearing the story, I guess. I haven't quite talked myself. You haven't quite persuaded me that I like this film, but I think you've, you know, defended it
maybe
well.
Maybe enough to make you maybe think of a second viewing, perhaps? Because I certainly think, like you said before, I think this will be a film that, like, it deserves or demands even second viewing. Because it's so, the whole thing, there's so many things you keep peeling away and there's more things. I really think this is an interesting film and really one of the best I've seen in a long time. I could easily watch it again right now.
Well, you know, I can't say I would definitely join you, but I felt originally that it was all style and no substance. I think there is probably some substance there. It's just, I didn't get on with it enough to really get into it. And I find myself irritated by little things like how they've squandered real life locations, actual people who are fascinating, and just to tell a story about a man in a hospital making friends with a girl. Like, I don't know. I have mixed feelings. And I dare say it is, you know, it's worth checking out. But I think put on your pretentious avant-garde hat to watch it and think about more than just what's going on the surface.
Yes, I agree.
So, I mean, if it's a stupid hat, like, what would it be? Like, no, how can we rate this, really? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. For me, it's, you know, it's really good. So it's kind of hard finding a kind of analogy for that. It's like, it's a flashy hat.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Like a Pope hat, Vatican
and,
style.
And people kind of seeing it at first or from a distance would be like, well, that's ridiculous. But like once you've put it on your head, it's it's warm, it's comforting, and it fits perfectly.
And if you have a good look at it,
it's just a good hat, no matter how it looks.
And if you go look close, there's loads of incredible detail and effort that's been put in. But you don't necessarily see it unless you scrutinize hard with your... You know, if you look at the tiny weavings and stitching, it's all there. The quality's there. But maybe it looks silly to someone who is sitting, maybe for my hat, the same hat, but it's in a stupid avant-garde fashion show. And I'm sitting sneering at them, thinking, oh, no one's actually going to wear these clothes. What stupid hats. I mean, they're so pretentious and stupid. Why? No one's going to say, let's just give me the watered-down version for the high street that makes some sense and isn't as pretentious and just visually stimulating for no reason. And it's too expensive. Like, it's kind of the same hat, but in a different context for me, I guess.
Okay.
I don't know.
So, yeah, it was a good discussion. Good discussion.
Yeah, so, you know, it's about falls. Lots of people falling off horses, off bridges, off stools, off, you know, counters after trying to get some morphine for an ill man.
Yes, and pedestals.
Yes, and it's a fall from grace.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
The title at first seems again kind of arbitrary, but no, it's I think it's quite layered in its meanings.
But like all falls, there's some pain to be had if you like your contemporary films to be a bit more. I don't know. There is definitely some pain from the fall for me. You might have learned from your fall. I feel begrudged that I'm bleeding and scabbed over. Anyway. Okay. Well, there we go. I think, you know, that says it all, really, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, no. I mean, there's so much more to say, but let's not analyse it too much.
Yeah, why did the Indian touch his eyebrows when he was anxious? Oh, yeah, because... we didn't think of anything because it was pointless.
Well, I don't want to go into it now. But, you know, all the like, little clues were there and it kind of sort of made sense to me.
Okay. Well, we should bid our listeners goodbye or whatever.
Goodbye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.